Welcome to The Buzz, the podcast of the Jazz Journalists Association, where we discuss news and views from those in the jazz media, writers, broadcasters, photographers, videographers, and other professionals documenting the entire ecosystem of jazz.
My name is Susan Brink, and you're listening to The Buzz, the JGA podcast. Our last podcast was part one of a conversation with Wayne Winborn and Ashley Kahn about the importance of archives for journalists. We now return to finish our conversation in part two.
You know, yeah. Stefan Harris talks a lot about empathy. He always talks about empathy. And, you know, Stefan's on faculty here at Rutgers Newark. I talk about really looking forward, Susan, and embracing the present. And he teaches his classes out of our jazz club. We have a jazz club on campus named after a former distinguished professor of history, interestingly enough, who loved music and was instrumental in getting that space. And Stefan teaches his classes out of there. But he so has his students interacting with the Institute, and we're trying to build closer ties between the Institute of Jazz Studies and our music program. We're going to do that. We're really going to continue to tighten that up as we expand beyond just the music program or just the library. But it's all with an eye towards understanding this valuable resource and what it can do and having it inform our efforts today.
Absolutely. It's relevant stuff. It's endlessly relevant, consistently relevant, mm-hmm. you know, and the lessons that one can learn from Lester Young and from Charlie Parker, you know, you can find modern parallels in the hip hop world and Robert Glasper and the ways that the music is reaching out and touching so many people today. The music teaches you itself. That's you know, how to think about it and how to think of this is such an important aspect of human activity in general. Right. And once you start to think of it on this larger level, suddenly it's not just about the dates and the names and whatnot, which are also important.
It's important, yeah.
But you start to see, this is the why of it. This is why I need to know this. This is why I should be excited and why I need to share it with my kids, with my students, with the, you know, whoever else is around who is going to, you know, benefit from having this in their lives. And which is really everybody, anyone who has ears and a soul, you know, is going to benefit from this.
There are two quotes that follow exactly what you're saying. There's this drummer I like. I haven't met him personally, but this guy, Makai McCraven, one of the younger guys out of Chicago, Bad Cat. And he said, I saw something on YouTube he was doing, and he said something like, we were taught how to play, but we weren't taught why you play. And that's what we're trying to figure out now. And to that, I changed it in my mind too. You've been, because jazz education is wonderful in this country, just incredible. I'm out here, we just went to a performance last night at the Stanford Jazz Workshop that Jimmy Nadell has been doing now for 50 years, amazing. And they do a jam session afterwards in the coffee house on campus. And so you have these high school kids, and these kids swing and play changes, I think, much better than my generation. I mean, these kids are playing Donna Lee freshman year in high school. So jazz education is in a really, really great place. But the why of it, like, why swing? Why do you play the blues? And they've got to figure that out. You know, that's no easy thing. It's like finding their own voice on their instrument. So that's one quote that flows exactly from what you were saying. The other one is something that Branford has said to me. He said it in public a lot, too. Branford has really been going back deep. I mean, look, talk about original source material.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, last time we really hung out, he had been listening to all of this early Lester Young. Literally, he's got the stuff on his phone. We had arguments, by the way, and I lost because
Wait a minute. Branford was arguing?
Oh, yeah. We've been doing that for 35 years. It's fun. And he was right about South Africa because he pulls it up on his phone at that moment. But he says, Wayne, he said this publicly too. I've seen him. He said, the further back I go, the more out my playing becomes. He says, I'm not sure what it is. And I think it's exactly what we're talking about. He's using that source material. He's doing archival research, if you will, not to mimic it, to inform what he has to say now.
Right.
He has contemporized it. It's a very, very deep thing. Cause I'd like, I don't know now, you know, he's a shapeshifter at times, but he was deep into some early Lester Young, deep into that stuff.
Well, you know? just the work he did most recently on the Ma Rainey Black Bottom, you know, film. Oh my God.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
To get into the skin of that music and to find the right musicians. That's absolutely one of the most amazing musical feats of revisitation of the past 10, 15 years. And I'm so sad that I think it's going to be overlooked. But it's the type of thing that archives, and I mean, to bring it back around, you know, to reconnect it.
Yeah, and he's got some things that didn't make the score, by the way. He's got some things written that he's played. We did an online conversation during COVID. Scotty Monart and I teamed up and we were doing these conversations and we had Branford. And he played some stuff for us that hadn't made the score that he had recorded. And
wow.
It was so fresh and yet so rooted and totally worked for that time. He got it. He immersed himself in it.
Yeah.
Got it. There was an authenticity to it, you know, and it was fun. I mean, it was good music, you know. So, yeah.
You know, I do want to say one other thing too, Susan, and this is why I was so kind of excited by the choice of focus for this conversation, is that part of what like Micaiah McRaven is talking about is this sense of connection and community. You know, Stefan Harris, of course, talks about this all the time. Christian Scott, a.k.a. Chief Ojiwa, you know, is talking about this all the time, that it's a sense of connection that moves this music forward and that really keeps it alive. And that idea keeps feeding into the courses that I teach, the writing that I do, but also the sense that there are so many individuals and forces at work that make the music community happen, that make the music legacy happen. It's not just the musicians themselves. It's also those who support it. So, you know, the nightclubs that Wayne mentioned, the writers themselves. And for me as a writer, and this is, you know, just a personal aside, watching how jazz writing, let's just talk about jazz for a second, how the writing about jazz changed in the language, in the use of certain terminology, especially racial terminology, over the years from the 20s and 30s up to the 50s and 60s, the advent of someone who had such a timeless, forward-thinking way of looking at it, like Nat Hentoff. Right. Or Marshall Stearns,
right.
You know, who was at the root of the creation of the Institute for Jazz Studies. And later, super researchers like Dan Morgenstern,
right.
All of these cats. And then later, you know, Greg Tate and like his writing,
right.
which was incredibly influential on my young 18, 19, 20-year-old mind when I was first getting into the idea of like, am I going to make music or write about it? And I went down the path of supporting it through writing. That history in itself is amazing. And for anyone out there who's thinking about doing anything from, you know, we call it history and criticism in the academic world. But the idea of like writing about creative expression is a very important and very significant and ongoing, living, breathing kind of tradition. And it would only be, I would only be able to like dive into it and know it because of archives like the IJS.
And it's really, it is a field in flux right now because fortunately, a lot of newspapers don't carry reviews of either recorded material or performances. But I think it's still critically important. And I think it's still very influential. I remember, now this is long enough ago that people were still publishing reviews. A buddy worked at J&R Music World and—
Who?
Hyland Harris. You don't know Hyland?
No.
He works at the Louis Armstrong House now. I mean, talking about historian. So he actually came to Rutgers and got a master's degree in justice.
I remember a bunch of people who were there, like Brian Backus. Butch Morris was working
Butch
there.
Butch was, I thought, I had Brian at Tower. Was Brian ever at Tower too? Or was he?
Brian Backus, yes.
Yeah, okay. So I had him at Tower. Yeah. Hyland was another one of these guys, man, just jazz heads, incredibly knowledgeable, access to all kinds of bootleg recordings of stuff and da, da, da. And now I've completely lost the point I was going to.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, I've forgotten now. No, old age. It was going to follow up on something you'd said. I can't think of it now. Yeah, I'll tell you what happened. As you took me, I really loved JNR. And as you're saying, there were all of these cats who came through. The staff were all so knowledgeable. Oh, I know what it was. The staff were all so knowledgeable. And I spent so much time there. It got to the point where I used to say, okay, I've got to, I am not going to spend over $100 because I don't have this kind of money to be spending on album. And I hadn't even, Susan, it took me a while to switch to CDs because I just couldn't afford to like get a whole new stereo setup. And now am I going to reproduce stuff I already have in vinyl? You know, and then the prices shortly after, of course, the prices on CDs and CD players came down dramatically. So even a bad CD player sounded pretty decent, you know. And then the record in jazz, the record labels were throwing in all kinds of things, alternate takes of stuff, you know. And for a jazz nerd, it's just, wait, there's an alternate take of Libby Spaulding and Freddie Hubbard on you know, for speed's sake, I must have it, you know. So this JNR at that time was a treasure trove. What I was going to say was about in terms of the importance of writing, even in a context now where we're moving away from that. I think it was Hyland who told me, so, you know, JNR used to say what the top selling jazz record was, you know, this, you know, they'd have like their top 10 or something like that. And I remember he told me, oh, man, it's this box set of whatever it was, box set of Charlie Parker stuff. And I was like, wait, what? That's the top selling thing this week? He was like, yeah. Somebody wrote a review, and I've forgotten who it was. Yeah, Ashley, between the two of us, we could figure out the time of who it was. Wrote a review in the Wall Street Journal. And the thing sold out like 2 days later. People just came down. And I was like, wait, are you joking right now? He says, Wayne, if somebody writes a review, particularly in the Wall Street Journal, or if somebody can get a good review in the Times, we see it like in the next 2 days.
Yeah. By the way, I should add that I was confusing JNR with Tower, you know, which was a whole nother scene. That's where right. Butch Morris and Brian Backus were.
That's right. You know, Ralph Moore worked there too.
But the idea of like these vinyl meccas being home to such important people, I mean, it goes back to the Commodore record shop in the 40s.
That's exactly right.
Milt Gabler, who later was the head of Decca and would record and produce Billie Holiday, he was in charge, and his number two was Billy Crystal's dad, Jack Crystal.
Oh, I didn't know that. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's great. So the history's alive, Susan.
it's everywhere. I mean, again, you know, I don't think jazz is one of those places where you can, you know, I'm not sure I'd want to go to a jazz museum or a jazz shrine, but a jazz archive, hell yeah.
Yeah.
That's where I would want to go.
Yeah.
Because it's not the kind of expression that connects itself well to the idea of like, you know, a marble, you know, forever kind of representation,
It's living and breathing.
Always.
I mean, I think if you tied it to like the local, like a local museum and they talked about here's our scene, you know, something like that. But it's, yeah. So you're saying, I'm sorry, I cut you off. So you say, it's living and breathing. I think you're right.
It's living and breathing. There's a Yiddish expression of the door, which is from one generation to the next. Mm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it comes alive, is in the archives, when you can hold it and touch it, and it infuses us. So Ashley Kahn, Wayne Winver, thank you for talking about archives with us today on The Buzz.
Susan, thank you for making this happen.
Thank you.
My name is Susan Brink, and I am the host of The Buzz. The subject is Archives, the ABCs of Archives. And I'm here with Reuben Jackson, the archivist with the University of the District of Columbia's Felix E. Grant Jazz Archives. Reuben, hello.
Hello. Good to see you. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. So what exactly is an archive?
It's an organization. Obviously, it's a physical space devoted to collecting, preserving, and making available for researchers. And by researchers, I mean you can be a fan, you can be working on a book, a thesis about, in this case, like the jazz archives here at UDC, ideas, musicians connected with this community. For example, there's a guy I've been working with lately. He's doing a book on a club here called the One Step Down, which no longer exists. So, you know, we make donated materials available, again, preserving them. This is a broad term, but cataloging them, creating guides or finding aids for people to access this stuff, you know, and my job entails all these things. It's like when I have volunteers, God bless them, you know, who help me do the unromantic work, you know, like with musicians, like you're changing reeds and all that. And a lot of the stuff we do is not romantic, but it's necessary to keep these materials in good shape and things like data entry. So archives are kind of multitask oriented organizations. I just made that up.
is there a fee to go to an archive?
I think it varies from place to place. Here, you just call and make an appointment. Now, on-site appointments, this will change in the fall when the fall semester starts. But what we've been doing, no fee for us. I've been doing a lot of virtual research, you know, with people. And again, it varies from place to place. But for us, you just make an appointment. Let's just say like it's the before times, as kids say. You call, say you have an appointment you're working on. Oh, again, like this gentleman, you know, you're looking at materials connected with this storied DC Jazz Club. You come in, you know, you have like a little reference interview and you fill out a registration form. I pull materials and you go from there.
Okay. Okay. Do you have to be a student? So it really can be anybody?
It can be a student. A lot of like, again, I keep referring to this guy because this has been my latest encounter. And I have to say, as a nerd, an archival nerd and a music nerd, the joy for me is metaphorically like trading fours with people who have this fervent interest. But no, you can be a university student. You can be a quote layperson. You know, that's not really, there's no restriction on that as far as criteria is concerned.
Right. So there's archives associated with various universities and like Louis Armstrong House, there's an archive there. So various musicians have their own archives.
That is true. I mean, for example, like the collections here, we required materials of a gentleman named Bill Harris, who's a guitarist. He is also a business person. He had a club here called the Pigfoot, which was, I think it closed in the mid 80s, and his son donated materials. So we do have, you know, collections, like it's the Bill Harris collection, and it's, you know, photographs and business records, newspaper articles, that kind of thing. But, you know, you have, yeah, materials documenting the lives of musicians. We also have, like, the university here had a jazz station for many years, and then things got rough financially, and the city took it over, the control board took over, and they changed. It was WDCU, and then it became like a C-SPAN offshoot or something. But we have their records. It's a fascinating collection, and I think a lot of the things here, and this is not unusual for any repository, okay, you know, they are subject specific, but you also get a sense of, it's like the arc of the community. You know, you'll see photographs of like city council people who were interviewed for public affairs programs, musicians who came in and out. So it's a real You know, like if you look at a score, you got like first trumpet, second trumpet. It's like that. You've had many staves. And I think that to me, I mean, I'm biased, but one of the riches of archival collections is that they are multi-tiered stories, you know, and I think in helping people, I learn a lot more. I grew up here. And one thing I always do, not that you asked me this, but I always take a day. So we get a new donation. I give myself a day to let, it's like the fan / longtime DC resident go through it before you start. You know, you take a couple of steps back and deal with beginning to organize it, because it also reminds me that I'm not 25 anymore, but that's okay.
But it recreates a world when you start doing research.
Beautiful.
And you That's go into world. An archive.
Yes.
You're recreating that world as it was lived. You can feel it. You can feel
it. That's beautiful.
You know, yes. You're holding, you're listening to the music of that time. Right. You're seeing the council people and the club people and the patrons, right. What they were wearing, what they were thinking. Exactly. What the newspapers will show you, the ads of the day. You see what they were saying and what was important.
Yes.
So
yes.
You absolutely marinate, and that's what you're basically saying, is you spend a day marinating in
the work. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
You know? No, and letting it seep in so that when you start pulling it apart to catalog it.
Yes, yes.
You have a way of knowing which way to go, because there are so many different ways it could go.
Exactly. Exactly. One of the things I love most is, say if you know, you call with a reference question, and I will try my best to answer that direct question, but not unlike the many ways you can address a topic by way of using a collection or collections. It's that there. So I'll talk to, and then I'll have these discussions with people. Could be some obscure Swedish bass player who was big in the 50s. And I mean, personally, for me, it's a chance to discuss all this stuff that's like stuck in my head for years. Like I was the kid who would tell his friends, like we'd listen to all the hit records in my parents' basement. And I'd say, listen to this record. And it'd be like, I don't know, some of the stuff like Quincy Jones did when he lived in Sweden. My friends would go like, oh no. And I'm talking about like, you know, Aki Persson, this great trombonist, and L. Rubin. But it's found a use, and you know, I have a job doing this. So it's, I use this metaphor a lot with trading fours with researchers, you know, helping them first and foremost. But it's professionally rewarding, and well, to use Quincy Jones, it like it makes my soul smile.
So to find an archive, if you have an interest in something, how would you do that? Do you just Google it, like your interest, or is there another way?
Yes. That's the simplest way. Again, I'll give you another example by way of a query I received yesterday. There's a guy he's read Bill Milkowski's Mike Brecker biography, which came out in October. And well, it's funny. He said, yeah, this guy in Newark told me you should call a guy in UDC because he knows all this crazy stuff. And he meant it in a complimentary way. And
yeah. I went,
thank you. Thank you. I'll put that on my headstone. But
to know you, I love you, Reuben.
He's writing a book about the band Dreams, which was like early 70s, you know, Mike, Randy Brecker, Billy Cobham, all these people. And he was looking for other places where he might find additional material, because, well, he knows about like the Michael Brecker collection. You know? And I said, well, what you should do, among other things, is just get on Google and let yourself play with like thematic queries, you know, like so-and-so collection. You could do it on, you know, individual musicians, or you can call or email someone such as myself. But yeah, in many cases, you can just go on Google. And I mean, for example, like the Duke Ellington collection, where, you know, I work for 20 years, you just type in Duke Ellington and you get, I think the first or second hit on Google is like, you know, Smithsonian Archive Center, Duke Ellington collection. But I always tell people, never hesitate. If you come upon a repository website and you're not sure there's anything, but that's what we do. So just, you know, as the cool kids say, just hit them up and find out. And hopefully they can, if they don't have something along your research road, let's put it like that, they can say, well, you should try this or this or this or this. So, and as you know, people, this guy yesterday was so like, oh, you're so thankful, you're so patient. I said, you know, it's what I do. And I don't really have to, well, I wouldn't fake it anyway, but you can't, like, I love it. How the heck could I fake it? You know, I'm like, sometimes I feel like the Maytag repairman, like, oh, somebody. And other times it's like, okay, I'll have to call you back. It's crazy. I'm happy. As someone whose life, like yourself, has been so profoundly shaped by this music and these musicians, you know, I'm a so-so musician. But I think the greatest thing I could do to honor what they've done for me is to make their materials available for people, you know, who will be interested, knock wood, you know, long after I'm like, as I told my cousin the other day, an urn on his mantelpiece. You know?
Yeah. And that's the beauty of archives. They survive us.
We put your best in,
you take care of it, and you pass it on to the next generation. And
that's the beauty of it. Yeah. So,
thank you, Ruben. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me.
Oh, it's so much fun. It's so much fun.
Sponsors of the JJA include the Berklee School of Music, Joyce and George Wien Foundation, Jazz Foundation of America, and SF Jazz, San Jose Jazz, Stanford Jazz Workshop, Monterey Jazz Festival Kumba Workshop, and the Peabody Conservatory. The Buzz is produced by Jeffrey Siegel and features the music of John Michaels performing the tune Big Vic. Thank you for listening, and please come back in 2 weeks for the next edition of The Buzz.